This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Today on the program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer explores the newly restored and historic El Encanto Hotel high in the Santa Barbara Hills. Also, Chrissy Hewitt brings us another edition of Ears on Art as she talks with the education coordinator of the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art about children's art classes, the learning process, and how to engage students so that art becomes an integrated part of their lives. But first, Lynn Deal finds out what roots one local family to the land generation after generation as they grow vegetables and wine grapes and offer harvest boxes to the community.
Dwight Eisenhower was once quoted as saying that farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from the cornfield. I'm Lynn Deal for KCBX Issues and Ideas. It's July, and America is celebrating its history, a time to unfurl the flag, set off the fireworks, and celebrate our protections and freedoms. Of the signers of the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776, most were lawyers, but 9 were farmers. The colonial economy revolved around farming. 4 out of 5 people were farmers, grains and livestock, tobacco and rice. It was do or die and not much room for error. Fast forward 237 years and farming is still very much a way of life, especially in California, where independence and innovation is passed down generation to generation, where a farm is never far away. The village of Arroyo Grande is like a gateway to some of the best destinations on local back roads. Quaint shops and eateries give way to Lopez Drive with sun-drenched hillsides, friendly neighborhoods, and bucolic landscapes. Soon, you'll glimpse the rich soils so prized for farm crops, and then the sign for Talley Farms on one side, Talley Vineyards on the other.
My grandfather started farming here over 60 years ago, back in 1948, and one of the things that people often say when they come here for the first time is, wow, what a beautiful place to come to work, and that's something that I try not to take for granted, and I really appreciate what a special place this is.
Brian Talley is third generation of an agricultural success story, with its roots planted literally and figuratively 65 years ago by Oliver Talley. It's a sense of place that no amount of marketing can create, an authentic story that was shaped by Depression-era experiences.
My grandfather did not come from a farming background. He actually, his first jobs and really kind of where his family came from were from the oil fields, originally in southern Monterey County, and then they moved down to Santa Maria. He graduated from college from UC Berkeley during the Depression, and like a lot of folks that came of age at that time, that really shaped his perspective and his vision. Consequently, he didn't buy any land until my dad and my uncle came back to the business in the late 60s.
How did he choose this part of Arroyo Grande?
Well, he had been farming with a gentleman down in the Santa Maria Valley and a guy named Byron Tabb who decided to relocate here to Arroyo Grande. And at that time, my grandfather became his partner and eventually bought him out.
It was a good place to grow.
Arroyo Grande in the produce industry has always been considered sort of a subset of the Santa Maria Valley, which is recognized as one of the key vegetable growing districts in California. Early on, he figured out that this area was really well suited for things like bell peppers, and consequently that became his specialty and continues to be our specialty to this day.
Did he get his hands dirty, or was he primarily business overseeing?
During that time, there were basically 2 or 3 people working here, and so he really did get his hands dirty. I mean, it was as he used to say, he worked from can to can't, from when you can see to when you can't. Worked very, very hard, and that's something that my cousins and I, as you know, we're now into the third generation, we really try to reflect on and appreciate the very hard work that my grandparents, really both my grandfather and my grandmother, put forward to make this business successful.
Hazel and Oliver Talley grew vegetables, raised a family, and built a way of life. But there were some lessons that Oliver wanted passed along.
And my grandfather, he once told me, he said, you know, you have to be very careful with banks. They'll give you enough rope to hang yourself. And so he really was very concerned that we could become over-leveraged, over-committed. And so consequently, you know, he had a very, very conservative outlook.
Hazel and Oliver put the farm on stable ground, building the foundation that would allow sons Don and Ken to buy the land and expand the vision. Ken graduated from Cal Poly and Don from UC Berkeley. The two young men would marry, have children, and in the early 60s buy land, and in the 70s buy more. In 1976, Ken, only 30 years old, passed away. Rosemary, Don's wife and Brian's mother, began to build the sales and marketing. To this day, she brings history and perspective to all aspects of the operation.
You mentioned your cousins, and I guess let's fill this out a little bit. Who does what in the family?
Well, my focus, you know, really for the better part of the last 20 years has been on the winery side. That changed fairly significantly when my dad passed away in 2006. I, right before then, got more involved again in the vegetable farming business. In that business, my two cousins really run the day-to-day operations. My cousin Ryan is the director of our farming operations, so he really handles everything outside of the office. And that's just such a critical role in a vegetable farm. Then his older brother Todd is our CFO, and so he's the inside guy. He's the one that oversees really our sales department as well as all of the financial operations and administrative functions of the company. And well, my mom ended up getting involved in the business when my uncle, so the father of Todd and Ryan, his name was Kenneth, he passed away in 1976. And at that point, you know, my grandfather, his role in the business was starting to diminish a little bit. He was getting older, and my dad really realized that he needed someone to help, and my uncle had been that person before. So that's when my mom stepped into the business. We had just started selling our produce directly ourselves, and so that's the role that she really took on, and really took that from something that was a very, very small thing to really turned us into a fairly significant grower, shipper, packer of fresh produce.
Here at the winery, it's you and Janine, is that correct?
That is right, and we are assisted by a very, very capable management team. You know, we have folks like Michelle Good who have, this is going to be her 20th anniversary with us, all the way down to a couple of young guys, our winemaker Eric Johnson and Travis Monk, our vineyard manager, two young Cal Poly graduates that just bring a lot of energy and excitement to the table. David Block is our national sales manager. He's been with us now for 10 years. And so it's really, I think, a very, very balanced approach that that folks bring to the table here.
Job longevity is a familiar quality here. In May, a ranch barbecue celebrated 16 employees with 25 plus years and counting.
The farming side of Tally, is it just here in Arroyo Grande, or do you have other locations?
You know, at this point, it's really just here in Arroyo Grande. Over the years, we have farmed in other parts of California, as far south as Brawley in the Imperial Valley. We've farmed up in Brentwood, which is kind of a suburb of the Bay Area. But, you know, as we've really, really looked at those ventures, we've just come to the conclusion that our best focus is right here. We have a very diverse array of crops that we grow. Now with our harvest box, it's about 20 different items. So we really focus here in Arroyo Grande.
The harvest box, how did that come about?
Well, Fresh Harvest started really as just kind of an experiment. About 3 years ago, we decided to do a real small-scale CSA here at the winery, and it was a huge success, except for the fact that we really didn't have the resources of the manpower to get it done. So we ran it just for the summer and the fall and then stopped it. A lot of people wanted us to bring it back, and so the second time around, we really went through a very thorough process. We wrote a business plan, really looked at how we would do it, and we were very, very fortunate to find a woman named Andrea Chavez, who runs the program, who a lot of people have gotten a chance to meet. She just brings so much energy and excitement to the program. She came from the produce industry, and so a lot of folks know her in that regard. She's very seasoned, and actually her husband helps us out quite a bit too. Randy Chavez, really great, longtime produce buyer, knows quality, and it's just been a phenomenal success.
You mentioned quality. That's part of the Tally Farms motto. Quality is what we do. Right.
It is. And actually, the tagline that we use at Tally Farms is excellence in everything. And, you know, it really reflects our commitment that if we cannot be excellent in a particular endeavor, then we really don't want to do it. So quality is the underlying, I guess, unifying factor for everything that we do.
Did you learn that from your parents?
Yes. You know, my dad, that was something that he always really, really emphasized to me. His saying used to be that in the produce business, you don't always get the price you want, but if you have quality, at least you can sell the product. My dad, you know, he was very much a visionary, a true Renaissance man. He decided to start the winery, start planting vineyards and then eventually start the winery, partly because he really loved wine. And, you know, he also saw wine grapes as a real nice diversification for our business. I had the pleasure to be able to work with him for, since I started working here when I was 12, until... shortly before he passed away in 2006. And, there were a lot of days where I got to, you know, first thing in the morning, we just sit and talk about what we were going to do. And I learned a lot.
What do we not know about your dad? Okay, Brian's laughing.
Well, I this might not be the most flattering thing, but I think it's one of the things that led to his success. I mean, my dad, he really came off for most people as being such a gracious, very patient guy. It turns out he wasn't really that patient, and he had sometimes a bit of a short temper, especially with the people that he trusted. And, you know, he let you know right away if you were off track. And that's good because in business, we don't have a lot of time to waste kind of floundering around and trying to figure out the right way forward. And so I think that's something that people probably didn't know.
In 2007, the entire Tally family was named the Grand Marshals of the Arroyo Grande Harvest Festival. And online in the festival archives are family remarks and remembrances worth reading. The family grew vegetables, then wine grapes, and helped grow the larger community. The public service list is long and growing with each generation.
And that's something that everybody in the family is very, very committed to. My cousin Ryan is very active with the Arroyo Grande Hospital Foundation Board. And so through his efforts, we're able to support that. Todd is very active in a number of activities in San Luis Obispo, now most notably the Classical Academy, which is a neat educational opportunity.
The collaborative Mano Tinto wine raises money for the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers, an endowment that benefits farm workers in San Luis Obispo County. An annual fun run raises scholarship money for college-bound athletes in honor of Brian's sister, Marianne Talley, an athlete and avid runner who passed away in 1983. The 20th run was marked by more people participating than ever before.
It's really a wonderful thing. It's my favorite day of the year.
The third generation is now teaching the fourth.
Final thought, since you learned so much from your parents, what do you think your kids are learning from you?
That is a great question. I just try to emphasize with my kids just open and honest communication. That's been something that's been a hallmark, I guess, of what I've tried to do.
Visit this summer and you'll likely find a Tally in the field or behind the counter.
My girls, one of the things that they have been able to learn is that it really takes hard work.
And if you run into Brian Tally, just know he's happy to be here at home and at work in Arroyo Grande.
I have gotten the opportunity to visit a lot of other places, and I always love getting off that airplane in San Luis Obispo. And this is a very, very special place. I love to travel. I love to talk to folks all over the world, but I love coming home here to Arroyo Grande.
I'm Lynn Deal for KCBX Issues and Ideas.
You are listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Still to come on Issues and Ideas, a local art museum's education programs. But up next, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to the newly restored El Encanto Hotel on the Santa Barbara Riviera.
Tom Wilmer reporting from Santa Barbara, California. It's known just as the El Encanto. The 7-acre estate-like property has had an intimate relationship with Santa Barbara locals and discerning travelers from all quarters of the globe for close to a century. The El Encanto is one of those rare and very special, iconic California coastal resort destinations, much like the Biltmore and the San Ysidro Ranch, that have been discreetly catering to travelers since the early days of the 20th century. Recently, following a 7-year, $134 million renovation under the direction of Orient Express Hotels, the structures were stripped to the bare bones and lovingly restored. The El Encanto's doors have now reopened with all its historic charms intact. But with the addition of posh new furnishings, glistening hardwood floors in the cottages and bungalows, and a new state-of-the-art spa, ballroom, and more, while retaining the profusion of ancient wisteria, towering giant birds of paradise, and flowering gardens throughout. Come along and join me at the El Encanto for an exploration of discovery. Laura McIver, the general manager at the El Encanto. The El Encanto has a connection with my history going back more than 20 years. I love this place. I fell in love with it the minute I saw it, and it eventually closed, and I went, oh no. And then I learned recently that it's now reincarnated as the new El Encanto.
Reinvented. Yeah. The same, only better. We have so many people that have come here that also have a history with us from years and years and generations upon generations of people that have visited with us that are so excited that we're back. We've had a tremendous feedback from the community.
It truly and literally, not figuratively, has been and continues to be a part of Santa Barbara's history for approaching a century.
Absolutely. Dating back to 1913, when it was born as the dormitories for the state school, which would have become the University of California, Santa Barbara, which is now a little bit further out of town. And it didn't work, so it was turned into a hotel, which did work.
Mm-hmm. And that was around 1917, as I recall?
1918.
1918.
Absolutely.
A seminal period of American history, America's going to war and going into the roaring 20s, and this is instantly the place to stay in Santa Barbara.
It really was. It was a hideaway for celebrities coming up, journeying up the coast from LA, and they loved it. They made it their home, their getaway.
As I recall, there were CEOs of major East Coast corporations, Aero Shirt Company and whatnot, who would come out here to hide in the wintertime from the snows of Chicago or New York.
That's right. And as you can see today, with our sunny, beautiful 75-degree weather, there's no place better to be than Santa Barbara.
The beauty and the allure of this place is almost the intangible. It's like being up in the sky. You're literally looking down at the city of Santa Barbara from a bird's eye view. So let's just start with what you see looking out.
Absolutely. We have almost a 300-degree view of Santa Barbara. We can see the mountains behind us. We can see the bay in front of us. We can see the red tile roofs of Santa Barbara that make Santa Barbara so iconic. We can see the Mission. We can see the downtown spires of the courthouse.
But we're talking about 1,000 feet below us.
That's
or something,
right.
Isn't it?
That's
I mean,
right.
We're way up there.
We are about 1,000 feet up, and so we have an amazing view. We can even see out to the Channel Islands on a very clear day and out across the Pacific.
So you have this inner and outer world. You have this, oh my God, panoramic Pacific vista out to the Channel Islands. And then you have this intimate, close-in look.
Once you're inside the resort, it is very intimate, very close, and very quiet. A really amazing place to be introspective and to walk the gardens and to see other people walking the gardens. People have a really good respect for each other here on this property, and you see people with that smile on their face, just sort of remembering maybe what their wedding day here or an anniversary or another special occasion that they spent here on another time.
Let's talk a little more about flora, because that's alone. If you took the buildings away, it would be a great garden tour.
Absolutely. We actually get requests for quite a few garden tours. We had one quite recently. recently from the Beverly Hills Garden Club. They came up and toured and had lunch with us, and it was a beautiful, beautiful day. Most of the gardens have been kept in greenhouses through the renovation. We have 100-year-old wisteria vines that climb the arbor above the lily pond that were kept in place on scaffolding during that renovation and meticulously cared for. We've had an arborist and a horticulturist throughout the entire process, 6.5 years, making sure that all of the landscaping and gardens came back as beautifully as they once were.
Let's talk architecture for a moment. Without the plants, if there weren't any, this would be a must-see place just to savor the art.
Well, Santa Barbara itself has really beautiful, iconic architecture in the Craftsman style and the Spanish Revival Mission style. This property was originally built with the Craftsman style bungalows that are really detailed and have that beautiful California shingle and batten board white clean look and are a little bit more intimate but have that beautiful detailing on the inside as well. And then the mission buildings were built after the 1924 fires and earthquakes that sort of ravaged Santa Barbara and made the downtown what it is today, really created that plan of Santa Barbara. And this property now is dotted with both styles of building, which make it really fit in with the neighborhood we sit in. Feel like you're in someone's home here as opposed to being in a resort.
And then there really is that classic California bungalow style, the Spanish Revival. You could do a book on each little cottage put together. You really could.
I'm sure you could, and they're all a little bit different, and they were all built in different times. Few at a time came up along the property as different owners and different people had visions of what they wanted here. And then we have the named suites. We have the Hummingbird Suite, which sits alone, and it is a beautiful 1,100 square foot suite with a fireplace and an outdoor shower, very intimate. We have the Wishing Well Suite, which of course has our beautiful wishing well sitting right outside it, which also is one of our luxury bungalows and very secluded, has a small kitchenette, and really you can feel like you've gotten away and really spend a lot of time in that room.
The building we're in right now is reception and the restaurant, but the sense of entry is like coming up to this incredible mansion. Was it somebody's house originally?
It actually wasn't. It was built to look that way, but it actually has never housed rooms in this building. The dining room, our new spa, and the new ballroom are all in this building, along with a few other meeting spaces, event spaces that were here in the original building. As people do drive up, it's a gorgeous Craftsman estate feel about it, and it really does have that sweeping view once you walk into the lobby.
Somebody once said there's only one class, and that's first class. And it's not a place for the budget traveler. It's a place for somebody, whether they're middle class or upper class, where you save your money and you earmark and you know you're going to pay a premium to come here. But there's an added value. I call it value added by experience, in that a year from now or 5 or 10, you still fondly and intimately remember your experience. And you don't at the Hilton Gardens. You don't remember where it was that you stayed. And that's the difference.
Well, you definitely won't wake up here and wonder where you are. It's not a cookie-cutter resort. It's not a cookie-cutter room. Every room is different and has its own little delightful touches that go along with this property.
Let's talk about some of the touches in the rooms that are special, because they truly are.
Absolutely. During the renovation, all of the bathrooms were enlarged and created with marble two-basin sinks and heated floors, rain shower head, and a separate tub and shower in every bathroom. There are 62 rooms that have fireplaces. Many of them have large gardens or private patios that people can sit and read the newspaper, have their coffee in the morning, have a glass of wine in the evening. Really lovely, homey feel.
I could come here, go to my cottage, and never leave the entire time and be happy and content. That's pretty cool.
We've already had people say that they never left the whole weekend, and they've had strolls through the gardens and room service delivered in and breakfast on the terrace, and they couldn't have been happier.
And that speaks volumes about this place.
It does. We've appreciated every moment we've had with those guests and hope that they have built memories. Even though they missed out on a little bit of the Santa Barbara charm, they'll just have to come back.
Talk a little bit about cuisine. Here it is, the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, and you have a great trade going on. This is a popular restaurant venue, obviously, and you're just brand new. in your reinvention?
We are brand new, and I think that speaks to the history of the property. We opened the doors and the restaurant filled up, and we've been about a week out on reservations. Very lovely place to meet and eat and have celebrations and business meetings, and it's been all kinds of people.
Sure, it goes without saying that it was the local gossip and networking that made this instantly happen. There's no other possible answer to have that instant popularity.
It is. People were really waiting for this property to reopen, and 6.5 years is a very long time, but there were people just clamoring for us to come back, and it was their local bar. They say, you know, that we do sit in a neighborhood, so it's very popular with the locals.
And this is, again, a part of Santa Barbara's history, and that I know people personally. Their grandmother first took them here as kids.
I hear stories like that all the time, and I see generations of families coming in for brunch, and the grandparents and the adult parents and the small kids, and they're showing their small kids now all about El Encanto.
Isn't that funny, where people in a community that have a place like this, there's a sense of possession, that this is partly theirs, they own it.
Absolutely. We've definitely seen that, and especially with the stories of people that have had generations here in Santa Barbara and have grown up really around this space, they feel very much a sense of ownership, and it's been really pleasing to see them come back and see that smile when they walk through the front door.
Speaking of locals, I know for a fact that this has always been, and I heard it still is, the premier coveted destination for wedding venues.
Absolutely. We have about 38 weddings currently booked through the end of this year and are starting to book into 2014, which is really exciting. It's definitely a place for romance for our locals and for destination weddings. We have quite a few people booking in from other states and other countries. We have a couple from London, a couple from Korea, a couple from Texas, some people from the Bay Area getting married here in the next few months. So it's really exciting.
My thought from the outside would be, well, it must be the gardens that hooks them. What is it?
I think it's a combination of everything. We have the beautiful sweeping views, the intimate feel of the gardens. We have a gorgeous arbor covered with wisteria vines that we really use a lot for the ceremonies. We have a beautiful new ballroom that we built during this renovation that didn't exist before. And it's just such a sense of spirit and romance here.
Let's talk about cuisine itself and what you specialize in.
Absolutely. We have amazing chef Patrice Martineau, who came to us from Tokyo and prior to that was in London and New York. He's French by birth, and so he brings a beautiful aesthetic to his food, a beautiful French and Japanese flair, but is using all of the local farms and fisheries from this area.
We saw his garden.
You did see his garden, and it's amazing that he's really hand-picked those Japanese herbs to grow in those tower gardens. And he will be extending that into raised garden beds as well so that he can really have more and more that we've grown ourselves.
We've been speaking with Laura McIver, the general manager at the El Encanto on top of the Riviera in Santa Barbara, California. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Tom Wilmer reporting from Santa Barbara, California.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Coming up at 2 o'clock on the next On Being, singer and composer Meredith Monk is a kind of archaeologist of the human voice. She says the voice could be like the body, flexible and fluid with practice. Through music, as through meditation, the longtime Buddhist practitioner pushes the boundaries of what we can do without words. She tells Krista Tippett what she's learning about mercy and impermanence, spirit, and play. That's On Being at 2 o'clock today on KCBX. Next on Issues and Ideas, it's Ears on Art with Chrissy Hewitt in conversation with the Education Coordinator of the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
This is the sound of something very special happening right here on the Central Coast. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program which explores the visual arts. My co-host Stephen DeLuca and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for California's Central Coast. The voices you just heard were young students enrolled in Summer Art Camp, a yearly program of the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. My guest today is Beth Mott, the Youth Education Coordinator for the museum. Our conversation will begin right after Ben Notley gives his take on being part of this camp. Others were eager to talk as well, and their enthusiasm will be heard a bit later. Here now is Ben. How many classes have you taken here, or thereabouts?
I want to say about 7. I've been going here since I was 9, and I do this every summer, and it's been fun every time. We do different stuff every time, so it's really enjoyable.
Different teachers and different styles.
Yep. The only teacher I've had a lot is Mr. Brian, and he's really nice. He's really funny. His only rule is you can't say can't. I just love this camp. It's amazing every year. Upstairs, we're doing like paintings that have a story behind them. We're doing a nice painting, and then we're breaking it down, and we're picking one that looks like other things also, and then we're doing that in a huge painting. We're doing a lot of fun stuff, and I bet that'll keep going on for a long time.
You'll find no argument from my guest, Beth Mott, about the desire to have this program continue for many years. I met up with Beth at her home in San Luis. It was now the middle of the afternoon. She had spent her morning, as she will many days this summer, at the museum, supervising, doing her job as youth education coordinator. Most of this is done on the sidelines, as she has such total trust in her faculty. But they know that she is there if they have any needs at all. Good afternoon, Beth.
Well, good afternoon, Chris. It's nice to be here talking with you.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure. I had fun this morning seeing some of the students at work, and you know, you've been at this a very long time. Do you remember when you actually started?
Yes, I took over as youth education coordinator at the then Art Center and now SLO Museum of Art about 17 years ago.
My memory is that a very scaled-down version of this, as in one class a summer for maybe 2 weeks, was being offered by AAUW, who funded it. Several of us realized that we really wanted more to happen than 2 weeks. I believe that Arlene Perlich maybe was the person who contacted you, or do you remember?
It was Arlene, and it was with the recommendation coming from Dr. Bernice Loughran Nicholson, as so many people remember her from Cal Poly. I had come from about 12 years of being a visual arts specialist in northern Santa Barbara County for a school district, and this seemed to be just the right fit.
Describe what a visual arts specialist does.
In the education realm, it's a teacher at the elementary school that travels probably between 10 elementary schools on a two-week rotation. And if you're lucky to be at the job long enough, you see some of the young artists grow from kindergarten right on through fifth and sixth grade, and that's really exciting.
This, of course, was in the era when actual art teachers at a school weren't there anymore. So you were the traveling art teacher.
Yes, that's true. When I left that position, the position disappeared. This is the cycle that we go through. Artists and arts educators are such tenacious people that it doesn't stop any of us. We keep going because we know arts education, both visual and performing arts, are so important in the development of all children. We are not teaching an entire child unless they have a wide expanse of experiences in their daily lives.
If we back up just a little bit, where did your involvement with art start?
That's interesting. I don't really know. I dabbled around it at home, but not with much supervision. And even through high school, I had not had an art class in a public school situation. Entered college as a Spanish major, which I majored in for 2.5 years. Was taking visual art classes along the way. And one day I said, I don't want to do Spanish the rest of my life. I know I want to teach, but I want to teach art. I had more than enough for a minor in Spanish at that point. I had enough art banked up already that I still got out of college in 3.5 years.
And where were you going to school?
At UC Berkeley.
You finished with that degree and then had to get a teaching credential. Was that the next step?
Yes, and that's what prompted the 3.5 years of undergraduate, because it was full year study for a secondary credential. And even to this day, I hold a life credential at the secondary level.
You came to San Luis Obispo then, what year about?
Around 1990. It was too early for us to retire. We commuted down to northern Santa Barbara County for 3 years. It was a good 60-mile drive each way.
So Arlene Perlick became president, and there was no paid staff at that time at the Art Center because she had some time, started acting as an executive director. And it wasn't that we didn't want one. It was that we didn't have funding to get something like that going. It was with a great deal of pleasure and excitement that she was able to find you and that we were able to get a much broader program started. When you first took over as education director for the youth program, what sorts of things did you start putting together?
Well, the biggest challenge was I was new in the community and I did not know the local artists, but you quickly learn who they are and what they can do. Any artist who's going to teach at the museum really needs to have ownership of what they're doing, and they need to have input as to what they're able to do and what they feel the young people need when they're in a class. Our classes are not a drop in one time and have some fun. They're definitely drop in and have some fun and stay with us, because it is a sequentially built program. We're very lucky to be able to have it in the museum. Children not only have the advantage of visiting the exhibits and watching them make an impact on what they're learning in their art class, but also to watch the various members of the staff and what they do, how art comes in, what has to be done with art, how you turn a display around, and who the out-of-town artists might be who are visiting. So it's a rich experience that we're able to offer at the museum.
Expand a little bit about the concept of the sequential curriculum.
Our program touches both on two-dimensional and three-dimensional art. You never know until the children get together who knows what. We operate at very specific age level experiences. The 5 and 6-year-olds are together. The 7 and 8s are another group, and the 9 to 12-year-olds are a third group. And those are the three groups that meet during the morning at our art camps. In the afternoon, during the summer, we have teen classes, in the 3-hour teen classes in the afternoon. They sign up for a full week, and what happens between the first and fifth day is a gradual learning process, expanding what they know, and it's definitely a journey not only for the children, but for the teaching artists. The artists learn as much from the kids as the kids learn from the artists. At the end, if what the children have produced all looks alike, then we've really failed. This is a program that is process-oriented and not product-oriented. So what you do one day is the basis for where you're going to step off and go a little further, make some decisions about how you're going to expand, or maybe not expand, but go in a different direction. It's a brains-on experience for all the kids involved. We do have a little art show the last day during summer art camps, and the parents all come in and see what everyone's done. They get a chance to talk to the artists. The artists have a time to tell all the parents what they had aimed to accomplish and where they had gone during that week.
I'm delighted to hear that you're able to create that kind of environment for these kids where they are not just accepting but eager to participate in that kind of way.
Well, our whole program has some real perks to it. You'll very often find a child who's come 2, 3, 4, even 5 years when they hit middle school, high school age. They are old enough that they can be hired as a high school aide. We do hire for each class an aide to back up the teacher, get the supplies where they need to be, get the room ready for them in the morning. It sure beats working at a fast food restaurant. Nothing wrong with fast food restaurants, but this is a wonderful place to work. Many of the students go on and continue their studies in the arts in college. We have one student down at UCLA who's majoring in art history and applied mathematics, a double major, and she is working at the Arm & Hammer Museum close to the UCLA campus. She gives tours to incoming art student families and also does research for upcoming exhibits that are going to be at the Hammer. So that's one of the stellar experiences that has come out of SLOMA.
If you have just joined us, you're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. My guest today is Beth Mott, Youth Education Coordinator for the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. We will continue our conversation as she tells us how she selects teachers and what she expects of them. But first, a couple more comments from some of the students themselves. First up is Emily Sullivan.
We're going to do paper mache masks. We have already done Mexican pottery masks. We did Mardi Gras masks with plaster. And I'm really looking forward to see what happens on Friday. Every week at the end of the week, we have a big celebration and show our parents all of our work. Everyone gets to enjoy each other's paintings.
Eager to add his comments is Nicholas Perez Lingi. Nicholas, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah.
How long have you been taking classes?
Probably here like at least 1 week per summer since like I was like 6 or something.
What different types of things have you done?
Like painting, drawing, sculpturing, weaving. Yeah, basically stuff like that.
No lack of enthusiasm here. This program is a hit. Beth Mott and I continue our conversation. Fortunately, her passion doesn't conceal well either.
Planning for a summer program, it's around March or so that the call is put out. If they're new, they can interview, and then we call all people who will be good teaching artists together. We spend several hours in an afternoon talking about what they would like to teach, what they feel is important, what they'd like to teach during the summer.
So they're all together having this conversation.
Yes, and it gives me a sense of which teams of three might work well together. I go home and I have Post-its all over for about 10 feet. They aren't all available the same weeks. Right. And you stir the pot a bit and see what works well together. You want a variety of experiences, some 2D, some 3D, experiences with different materials, different ideas. If something important is happening worldwide, like the Olympics were in Beijing a few years back, that summer we did Arts of China. We did sumi painting, and we decided that summer that we could be nicely artistic and economical if we used tracing paper. So each child got two pieces of tracing paper, and they sumi painted a background on one, and what happened in the background on the other, and laid them together and attached them to bamboo poles. And it was cool. Yeah.
Oh, I bet. What are you looking for in a teacher?
I'm looking for someone who has an idea, but not a final destination in their idea. Someone who can work with the children to build their awareness, help them concentrate on elements of art and principles of art, and discover what tools you use to make art to get your idea down. Before class starts, it's wonderful for the teaching artist and the students to sit together and just talk about what might happen that day. The students are asked to contribute their ideas as well as the teacher leading the discussion.
When you talk about having the idea but not having a firm sense of the destination, why that is desirable and what it really means?
Well, each student definitely brings a different background with them, what they've learned so far in their family life, in playing with their friends, in what they've learned in school. They're developing their own idea bank. They maybe don't know how to use it yet. We want to help them to be better communicators through visual art.
So the opposite of that would be more, this is the assignment, this is what your finished product might look like, here is paper and crayons, we're making butterflies today.
Yes, yes.
So one of your teachers, how might they do it?
Before they start, they're going to have to decide and tell me what materials they think they're going to use. If they're doing something with nature, we're in a wonderful spot because nature is certainly all around us outside the museum. The group can go out. They can look not in terms of lollipop trees, but which way is a tree growing? What's the texture of the leaves? Is it just one color? Does a tree have to be green? I would hope not. How much of your page are you going to use to describe the tree in your drawing? These are all wonderful opportunities.
There certainly are people who have a concept that you really can't teach art. Art is either a part of us or it isn't.
Everyone in the world is capable of doing art. Some of us have let it out sooner than others. Others keep it locked up a whole lifetime and never experience the joy of being an artist.
In that teaching, trying to pull out that individuality, how are the teachers helping the students come to an understanding of how pieces could be better than?
The students definitely need a time at the end of class to see what they have done and what all the other students in the group have done and be able to talk about it, to verbally say what they like and not, I like that because it's blue, but I like that because they mixed a very special shade of blue, something like that. And it's amazing. You'll talk to people from other museums who will have a tour group come through of students, and they can always tell if these students have had any of this type of training because they can speak much more knowledgeably about any art situation that they come across. There's a lot of good transfer in what we try to do into other arts experiences.
The state does have expectations and criteria. How has the state helped give structure to that education?
Yeah. The state has developed visual and performing arts content standards, and it helps anyone, teachers or otherwise, to understand how to build a student's perception of what they're going to do or what they're going to see, to be able to express it creatively, what you're doing and using materials, perhaps connecting it in some way to historical events or historical periods of art, or connecting to functional items that later have been accepted by society as artistic elements, and then to be able to aesthetically state, and that's a big word, but even the little kids can aesthetically state how they feel about something when they see it.
You mentioned earlier the fact that they are in a setting where they're able to see finished pieces that are either hung on the wall or on a pedestal, exhibits that are changing. You talked about the correlation with the Olympics in China, and I remember that early on, you were often doing that even just with the exhibit that might be in the major gray wing. I'm assuming that you're continuing to make those connections.
Very definitely. Just this morning, a class was going through, and we have one teaching artist, Brian Williams. He sets it straight the very first day. There are no wrong answers, that they're going to learn a whole lot. As they get going with their projects, he deals with each child individually, rotating through the room and really addressing where each one is. The whole group is moving along and growing, but he definitely makes sure that no one is left behind.
That expression of no wrong answers does seem to be one that's interpreted occasionally of everything is wonderful if it gets made. You've been explaining before of how to help that aesthetic development, that ability to assess, to judge, to mm-hmm. articulate. Sometimes those words don't mean much because it is such an emotional experience that you can't put it in words. But I've often said that to me the worst question is it art? Because there are two answers, yes and no. And if I've said no, then there's no more conversation. And it doesn't sound as though your students are being presented with what they are looking at in that way.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Right on.
Watched you working for so many years and the level of dedication, the level of dedication with your husband, Bob, who is the custodian of all custodians. I mean, he puts up tables, he takes down tables.
He eats cookies too.
I was going to add that because I love those cookies. The two of you in so many ways have made such a team effort out of this so that obviously your teachers are able to see that you're pitching right in, you're doing the work, you're not just sitting there saying, hey, you, do it. And I love the whole image of a group of people sitting down to plan something as opposed to Beth Mott sitting at her table in isolation saying, this is what we'll do.
No, definitely not. It's a team effort, and it's definitely ownership on the part of the artists. We have a very strong teaching team, always ready to add new people. You can't just keep one team going and going and going. You're going to die on the vine. It's very exciting to add the teachers. At the end of the day, especially in the summer where three of them are there at the same time, they take some time to stop and talk to each other and see what the other class is doing and sharing ideas. And
okay, so if I have a child that I think would be interested in this program, who do I contact? What do I do?
You go to the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art website. You go to education, and it maps out all of the classes that are being offered this summer. We have 4 more weeks coming up, 2 in July and 2 in August. It will tell you what the class content will be, tell you who's teaching. We're always happy to have both returning and new students. There are partial scholarships available, and no child is sent away. Everyone is welcome to have art classes at San Luis Obispo Museum of Art.
And the teenage program, is it also 5 days a week during the summer?
It is, from 1 until 4. Already we've had an abstract painting class from Julia Hickey, who happens to be a fairly recent graduate of Yale as an art major. Kathy Spencer-Canepa will be with us in July and August. We're bringing in live birds and animals, so that several things coming down from zoo to you. So it should be a lively 5 days. And our final week will be on our outside deck studio space with Brian Williams, and they're going to create a collaborative public art piece, which will be temporarily installed on the deck side of the museum.
Oh, this is so terrific. I am delighted to be caught up with where the program is now, and it has done its own growth and development over these umpteen years that you've been in charge. I don't know if you have some people that you're training along the way, because it's going to be very hard to replace.
Something wonderful will happen, and it isn't going to be tomorrow.
Well, that's reassuring also. Well, Beth, thank you so much, and have a great rest of the summer.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Krista.
This conversation with Beth Mott, Youth Education Coordinator for the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, focused on the summer camps that will take place through August. But it's important to know that the education program is a year-long event. Once summer is done, she coordinates an after-school program with different ages on specified days. They meet once a month at the museum, as well as a few satellite sites out in the county. Again, for more information about all of this activity, please contact the museum. Next week on this program, Stephen DeLuque will be interviewing Mark Beck, a painter who used to live in this area and has now moved to Albuquerque. His show is already up and viewable at the museum and runs through August 18th. I am Krista Hewitt, and you have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening.
And that's Issues and Ideas for today. I'm Brian Lanzone. Up next, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. Support for KCBX comes from the new Slow Natural Foods. It's still the co-op with a new name, new place, and more space. Anyone can shop and enjoy sustainably produced food. More information at slonaturalfoods.com. Support also comes from the Basin Street Regulars, presenting the High Sierra Jazz Band direct from the Three Rivers, California, along with Basin Street Regulars on July 28th at 11 o'clock. More information at pismojazz.com. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Let's see what's on the KCBX community calendar. Award winner guitarist Ed Gerhard, who has performed all over the world, will be appearing this Friday evening at the Coalesce Bookstore in Morro Bay. For all the details, check out the community calendar at kcbx.org.